Now, in the whole museum, every sound made was piped into every other place in the museum. Leading from the first floor to the second floor was a staircase that had, there was one from the first to second and one from the second to third floor, which had an electronic system which I designed for creating music on the stairway. And on the second floor, there were people performing, dancers, musicians, dancers performing on this staircase at the same time musicians were performing. Herbie Hancock played solo piano. Archie Shepp came with a group with Beaver Harris and Roswell Rudd. My group performed. Eric Ravat, who comes from Philadelphia, was in my group at that time. And he was playing. There was a group down from Buffalo from the Center for Creative and Performing Arts playing the new percussion quartet. Andrew White, who was at Buffalo 2 years before, performed a piece with them. Then on the third floor, there was a kind of setting which was relatively normal in terms of what you do when you walk into a museum or gallery. Normal in the sense that it's a kind of a passive interaction. You just walk through the rooms and you look. But in this third floor of my happening, outside of the main room, I had a popcorn machine which served free bags of popcorn. And then you take a bag of popcorn, you walk into the room, and on the floor, all over the room, this huge room, was gravel. And I wanted to encourage, perhaps, a sense exchange, synesthesia, where you change from, you could think you were eating gravel and walking on popcorn, or the reverse. That became even more complex when you walked into the room and there were 8 television sets behind a chicken wire fence from floor to ceiling. It was like a television wasteland, sort of. And all the television sets were tuned to the local stations. But you couldn't distinguish one sound from the other. You could hear them, but they were all at the same volume level. And some people, it was incredible because some people had the experience of being so fascinated by all of these television sets together until they had that sense exchange. You would see people spitting out the popcorn because they thought they were eating gravel.
Really?
Yes, it was incredible. Some people enjoyed the chance to look at all these television sets together because real television freaks, you know, who really dug the chance to see all the stations together, all the television sets together. Then one of the most incredible experiences of that whole show during the 3 years was that a friend of mine who works for the school for children who are deaf and who can't speak and who couldn't see brought about 6 children to the exhibition. And the exhibition frightened them at first, but once they were in the television room, it seems that the effect of the light from the television sets did something which tied the whole thing together for them. And they began to laugh, and then you just couldn't control them in that space. They really, really went through it, really enjoying it.
Must have been a very exciting experience for you to have created such a large and all-encompassing environment.
Yeah, it was. It was really a good experience for me.
What brought you to New York, where you live now?
Excuse me. Basically, I could say that I was I came to a point in Washington as a performer, as an exhibitor, where I couldn't get beyond the local status. And I suppose musicians and artists all over have found this to be true in their own hometowns. My group in Washington charged more than most local groups. Not enough to not enough fame to be hired as a major act at a couple of the major clubs in Washington, and charging too much to be a second act. And I found myself in a kind of position which meant I couldn't work. My playing was confined to private parties, which paid very well, and doing performances in schools. It seemed that I couldn't get out of the local status. That was one of my complaints about the scene. Then too, I felt the need to grow more musically and artistically, and I got hired to teach at Rutgers in '69, and the first year I was part-time, and I commuted to Rutgers from Washington once a week, and then the second year they made me full-time, and I thought then I was financially prepared to move to New York.
So. How do you like it there? I mean, does it? I mean, now you're not local. You're from somewhere else, and you're in, you know, like the largest city around.
It's been an education. It's been mainly positive, though. I've learned a lot in terms of my personal growth. I've learned a lot about the business of the arts, which I think any contemporary artist has to almost become a master at.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you think that you don't want to be directly involved in the business yourself, you have to have enough of a business sense to be able to know when you're being cheated and ripped off and who to hire to get the results you want. It takes a little bit of business skill to know that. I think if you don't want to be manipulated by gallery dealers and producers and record companies and so forth, you really have to learn how to do the business yourself.
Well, Lloyd, let's listen to a short solo piece from your new record now. The record is called Tori, and this is Tori Segment 3. It's a short solo from Lloyd McNeil's new record. Lloyd McNeil from his new album called Tori, and that was Tori Segment 3. Do you have any immediate plans for the near future that you'd be interested in telling us about?
I'm working now on the decision about the programming for the next album. I like to think of my albums as a whole piece, as opposed to just segments, separate segments. And I'm thinking now, just trying to decide about the arrangements of the pieces and the instrumentation and so forth. I have already composed the melodies for the music, and I just have to think now about the putting them in the right context.
Okay, well, Lord McNeil, I want to thank you very much for spending part of your afternoon with us here on Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Lloyd McNeil, who now lives in Manhattan, and the music that we've been hearing is on his own record label called Baobab Records. We're going to hear another selection now from his new album called Tori. I'd like to mention that he's going to be at the Tin Palace Club in Manhattan New Year's Eve weekend. That's this coming weekend, and he plays there about once a month if you're interested in hearing him. Okay, this next piece we're going to hear, another composition by Lloyd McNeil, is called Time Still, Pifaro, which means flute bird, and apologies for pronunciations there. We'll hear Lloyd McNeil on flute, Dom Salvador at the piano, Buster Williams bass, and Dumum Romeo percussion. Winning film star, but he's a star behind the camera, not on the screen. My guest is Garrett Brown, and he won his Oscar for his invention called the Steadicam. This Oscar was the first given in the technical category for 10 years. Garrett Brown's invention, the Steadicam, has practically revolutionized filmmaking. You've probably heard stories about the time, the money, the manpower spent on building tracks and stuff for special camera shots. The Steadicam has made a wide variety of previously complex shots simple. It's a camera that attaches to the body with a brace, and you can run and jump. And the camera does not jump. It maintains its relationship to the ground. If you've seen Rocky, Bound for Glory, Marathon Man, Equus, Saturday Night Fever, then you've seen shots with the Steadicam. Garrett Brown has done a lot of the shooting himself in some of these movies. When the camera was first invented, he was the only person who knew how to use it. He still does shooting, but he's also spending a lot of time teaching other camera people how to use the Steadicam. He's presently been working on a new film by Stanley Kubrick called The Shining. Garrett Brown continues to live in his Center City, Philadelphia home. Before becoming the inventor of the Steadicam, he was half of a folk singing duo, which we'll be hearing a selection from their one and only record a little later into this discussion. And then he later entered into advertising, where he got his film experience, and we'll also be hearing some of the advertising spots that Garrett Brown has done. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Terry.
I'm going to ask you to explain for us what makes the Steadicam real special.
Well, it's a difficult item to explain in words. It does lend itself to being seen, but it's a little like trying to explain an elephant to a blind man. We used to say it's 70 feet long and you can't smoke near it in the days when we weren't allowed to tell how it was done. It's gotten a lot more difficult to explain since we're allowed to describe it. It's what it does is give a cameraman a mechanical arm in addition to his own arms, which sounds pretty grotesque, but looks even more grotesque, I assure you. You wear a sort of vest, and the arm goes from the vest. It's sort of a spring-loaded arm. It's full of springs and pulleys and wires. And the arm goes from the vest to the camera, which is made a little larger by adding a video viewfinding screen so you can see what you're shooting, because I found out the hard way you can't be running along at full speed and keep your eye on the viewfinder. And so all of this is sort of floating around near you, suspended by this arm, which never gets tired. I've often wished it was a better-looking device. It looks a little strange, and the only place I've ever shown up to film with it that didn't get people a little crazy was New York, where it's perfectly ordinary to see three-armed men with sewing machines walking down the street, which is what this looks like when it's used. As a matter of fact, in an attempt to cover it up once, shooting in New York, we put a three-armed sweater on myself and put a garment bag on the camera. So now it looked like your basic three-armed man with a garment bag walking along the street. Garment bag strangely floating. And, of course, some little old lady on 47th Street walked up to it, listened to the garment bag, and said, "So, it's an Arriflex?" So, you know, apocryphal tales.
So you've got this bizarre attachment to your body. What are its special features? You know, what can you do with it that you can't do with a normal camera?
It lets the cameraman be about as mobile as he normally is, as the rest of humanity is. I mean, always the cameraman has been required to either, if he's handheld, been required to sit still or stand still or walk very, very gingerly in a, you know, gingerly fashion. And even then, at a walk, if you're watching the screen, you see what's becoming an unacceptable level of shakiness. Now, in the cinema verite days, we all sort of sold ourselves the idea that it was real and gritty and fantastic if, you know, the cameraman ran all around and the picture shakes. But really, your eye doesn't see the world that way. Your eye sees the world reasonably stable. And this gadget lets you, lets the camera see the world that way as well, even when the cameraman is, you know, walking or jumping or, oh, you know, we found you can sit on boats or ride in horseback or sit in boats and ride on horseback. And the shot is as stable as if you were rolling along on wheels. So a lot of places that could have used this thing in the early days, you know, westerns and things, well, now it's possible, you know.
Let's talk a bit about what this is replacing. What was the method prior to your invention of the Steadicam to creating smooth movement for a camera?
Well, I wish I could say that it has replaced those earlier forms already. It really is just beginning to happen. In places where there is a Steadicam and where there's somebody that knows how to use it, it's beginning to replace the old way, which was putting the camera on wheels of some sort. People used to go to extraordinary lengths to let the camera move 20 feet. They outdoors would lay mahogany rails and bring in a crane or lay steel rails or aluminum lately, very carefully shimmed up. And generally, moving camera shots tended to end up as straight line moves, as, you know, start at point A, move in a straight line to point B, which, of course, isn't necessarily the way one would choose to move a camera if you suddenly had the freedom of three dimensions. So
maybe a good way to illustrate the capabilities of the camera is to talk about some of the shots in movies that a lot of people have seen. Maybe one of the most...
Well, you and I just, before the show, were talking about a shot in Buddy Holly, which is a good example of that. I worked on that film, the Buddy Holly story, and my favorite shot in it that I worked on was... It's a shot that starts in a dressing room upstairs, and there's a little chat in the dressing room, and the Hollies and Buddy Holly stand up, walk out into the hall. The camera backs ahead of them about 100 feet past some very narrow obstructions, turns a sharp corner when they get into another hall, backs down the stairs ahead of them, five flights, goes under a very low thing, a sort of concrete thing that very inconveniently was placed there because I happened to be 6'6", so I was a little dismayed to find out that I had to get myself down to about 4'11 to get under this item, backwards, at high speed. Then the shot proceeds ahead of the three guys onto the stage and leaves them sort of gawking at what's going on in the, so you know, supposedly the Apollo Theater.
That was a great shot.
It was fun.
I really noticed that shot when I saw the movie. Now,
sorry you noticed it as such, because you're trying to be invisible. But, you
know. I didn't mean it like that. I didn't mean that its seams were showing, but I mean that it was just a really handsome shot, and an unusual one, really, because the space is very narrow, and that was
also,
really
I think cinematically it worked in the film. I mean, one would like to stay with them during that moment, and there was some good dialogue going on, and the old way would have been, on a big-budget film, to do some terribly elaborate crane job down a stairwell. You couldn't have done it on winding stairs like these were. Or to have done it in cuts, you know, walk-bys and cut to another angle and walk-by, which would have... It took us a grand total of about 20 minutes to shoot that scene, and it got them a minute and a half of screen time, nonstop dialogue.
The first movie that the Steadicam was used in, I believe, was Bound for Glory.
That's right.
And you did the shooting for that. That was,
yeah,
for those of you who haven't seen it, the movie about Woody Guthrie's life. What was it like that very first time when, you know, you were there on a big film set, a film directed by Hal Ashby?
Well, I assure you, my knees were banging together. I mean, I arrived there with this untried gadget, untried in feature terms, and discovered to my horror that the scene they devised was for me to stand on a crane, 30-some feet in the air, to be lowered, to step off the crane, to follow Carradine through the crowd for about 100 yards, hold some dialogue, and then back up another 50 yards. And all of this over obstacles and under tent ropes and so on. And they had 900 extras engaged, and I mentally added up what all this was costing and the fact that everybody just was trusting that this thing would work, you know. And I had no doubt the machine would work, but I figured that I would fall down in a stupor before I managed to get halfway through the shot. I mean, I stood up on the crane for a rehearsal, and it took a long time to get all 900 folks where they wanted them and arranged for me, you know. And the longer I had to stand up there, the more I reflected on what other careers I wish I had taken up and how to become invisible, or could I leave the machine up there for anybody who wants it signed, or, you know. And then, mercifully, they broke for lunch, and I managed to drink a couple of beers during lunch, and by the time I ended up back on the crane, I was perfectly content to be there. And, you know, we did three takes, one of which was interrupted by a poor fellow who didn't realize we were shooting because it was so unlike the normal paraphernalia. He walked up to Carradine in the middle of the shot and started to chat with him, and they used it on television later as an example of a very expensive outtake.
So, That was the very first shot you did. Were you happy with it when you saw it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the best moments I ever had was in the screening room the following day. Myself and a friend were there, and they rolled this shot. Of course, we were crossing thumbs and fingers and hoping it would look good, and they rolled the shot, and it looked terrific, and everybody stood up and cheered in the screening room on the, you know, in the dailies. So we knew then that, you know, we were home free.
For those of you who haven't seen the film, this is a film where David Carradine is in like a migrant labor camp, and there's, I guess, about 900 people, all those 900 extras, and he's moving through the crowd. And what kind of impression did that give you about the way movies are shot? You'd worked in advertising before that.
Well, I mean, I'd been in the film. In fact, at that point, was a film producer. I had made the jump from advertising to production company, and that was going well. My idea originally in advertising was to just try and get some experience shooting film. So I was familiar with a scale of filmmaking several orders of magnitude smaller than 900 extras. I think my maximum up till then was about 100 extras. So I was in shock about the economics of it all. I mean, just watching how it was done. And I also suddenly realized that they had along with them every form of wheeled conveyance anyway, and plenty of time to use them. So in the big budget feature business originally, I saw that the role of this device would be shots that they couldn't do in the conventional way, because all the conventional stuff they have, and still have most of the time, the wheels and the men to do. So a great deal of the stuff we've done has been the first category, the impossible shot.
Mm-hmm.
And just now we're getting into a kind of filmmaking which I very much like, which is shots which couldn't be done in other ways, which can be done a little cheaper or quicker this way, or perhaps with a little more fluidity, or, you know, that look better, or dramatically stay with it better, or that let you get an extra page of dialogue because you can step over the curb and keep going and not just stop where the dolly stops.
Another film that you did shooting for that I think probably a lot of people listening now have seen is Rocky. Which were the shots within that you worked on?
Well, I did a lot of shooting in the ring in Rocky, and also the shooting in Philadelphia, which is where production began. Lots of running around Philadelphia, and of course the shot running up the Art Museum steps, which has been much duplicated by everything from station promos to commercials. I myself have run up those steps more times than I would like to.
for the duplications.
For various, yes, you know, commercials and duplications and things. And just recently we did some more stuff running up the steps for the Rocky II, which was shooting here in November.
Do you ever devise the shots yourself, or does the director always have that, you know, written out in advance and has a shot that's either possible or impossible and wants you to come with the camera? In other words, how much input do you have into what a shot is going to look like when
you're
working with
a reasonable
the director?
Amount. I end up getting consulted, you know, because I'm very visible in terms of this particular piece of equipment, and so people assume that I have done various things with it that perhaps other people haven't done. So I do end up getting consulted about what we're doing. I find now and then that one will show up and a shot which is contemplated is very wrong for it, or could be done better with wheels. And it's, you know, to give credit where it's due, it's difficult for somebody to, just from the descriptions, visualize what exactly this can do. I mean, I get asked, you know, can you jump off this cliff and land down here and then levitate through the, you know, things that are impossible. And other times one will be asked very anxiously by a director, well, do you think you can start here and walk over to there and shoot? And I'll say, well, yes, I think so.
Or do you ever watch a movie and see... see like a great classic shot in film history and like want to redo it because you know you could do it better or differently with your
camera? Well, that's how it started,
really.
We used to specialize in so-called impossible shots when I was producing commercials, and I was always conscious, of course, of, you know, the limitations of the handheld camera, because one would wish the camera to be weightless. I mean, that's sort of the dream. You wish that it is a disembodied shape about the size of a cigarette pack that you can just give a push and it'll sail across the room. I mean, why should it be restricted? Why should you be tied down to, God forbid, the tripod or other antiquated devices, you know? I've thought of a shot, for instance, there's a shot in the original Exorcist, which I didn't take a great deal of notice of this shot when I saw the film. It involved a camera preceding some people up some stairs. And in a technical article shortly after that, I saw that it cost them $40,000 and a day and a half to shoot. They had to fly a cameraman up a staircase that was being disassembled as they went, and essentially, you know, to let this handheld guy in a sling on a huge crane and holding the thing. And, you know, I was already well into this thing at the time, and I was exultant reading that. I knew that I could stroll in there and do that shot in 10 minutes, you know, in a practical staircase.
You know, this strikes
Strange
me.
This, power.
This strikes me as being that kind of invention that once it's invented, you wonder why no one invented it before. But until it's invented, it doesn't seem at all obvious that something like that can exist.
I think it is. Yeah, it is. I wonder now why it took 70 years in the film business for it to happen. I'm just very glad that it happened, that I was able to do it before anybody else did. I mean, the history of invention is riddled with occasions where people arrive at the patent office from opposite ends of the country within a half an hour of each other. So when an idea's time is right, people think of it by sort of spontaneous combustion here and there.
You're very tall. You're 6'6".
Mm.
Would someone shorter than you are be able to manage the camera, which is, you know, basically attached to you through this vest mechanism?
Yeah, it's actually been unfortunate that I'm fairly tall, because people say, well, you've got to be a tall guy to use it. But in fact, I'd say the ideal height for it is about 5'10", 6 feet maybe. It really doesn't help to be tall.
Now, you also describe the video mechanism in which you can see what you're doing without having to look through a viewfinder. How can you see that either? Because like when you're running or something, you know,
Well, that's interesting. That's among the things that I learned when I was making experiments to do this. I found out one day that you could run alongside a freight train going slowly and read a 3x5 card typewritten on the train, even though you were running. The human eye has amazing ability to freeze the world, essentially, to stabilize what it's looking at. It just follows what you're watching. And it occurred to me that if you could run alongside a card and read typewriter print, then you could, as you're running, you could easily see a screen of that size and see what was on it and realize what you're shooting.
Can you operate controls? Can you focus or change light settings as you're doing
Well,
that?
Yeah. Generally, in the feature business, an assistant does that. We have a radio-controlled device that he runs along with and does it by wireless. It gets fairly esoteric, but in the old days I did it myself, you know.
Is this automation? I mean,
well, I don't know. In a funny way,
the film industry will be upset because, I mean, maybe your camera will help people lose jobs.
Well, in the beginning, we thought, you know, what if the grips get annoyed and they think it's putting people out of work and they start throwing these things down the hillside or, you know, frightening the operators leaping out from behind. But in fact, it's I think what'll happen is it'll let smaller units make more films. That's all. I don't think there'll be any less work for people as a result of it. What happens is there's just as much work for grips, but you get more done. You know, you can go out with a smaller unit and make a picture. And so pictures cost less, so these days that's a good thing. You know?
Yeah, maybe it would be nice if it really helped. Pictures cost less. So many people talk about how there's so few films being made now by the movie industry, and each one has an enormous budget as opposed to...
Unfortunately, everything we can do to help them cost less, and there's been a lot happening in the last few years to do that, is not really keeping up with inflation, in effect. So budgets are still crawling upward, but if films were made now the way they were made 30 years ago, budgets of $100 million, of $200 million would be common because, you know, we all have to shoot for less money even as it is now. Mm-hmm. Locations and things, you know, as opposed to building everything from scratch.
Let's go backwards in time a little bit, and then we'll get back to the present again. Before you became the inventor of the Steadicam, before I believe you even became involved with film, you were part of a folk singing group.
Yeah, that's right. It's a stale air.
It's called Brown and Dana.
Yeah, that's right. When I was second year of college, I conceived a dislike for college and the particular Navy scholarship that I had, and a great affection for folk music, although I sort of think I like the trappings of it as much as the actual music. I like the idea of being an entertainer. I always loved sort of, you know, standing around and cracking witty bon mots and so on, and the idea of being a singer appealed to me enormously, so I sort of created myself out of very rough cloth indeed. I've sort of taught myself to play the guitar, and I latched onto a guy who was a sensational singer and persuaded him that his life wouldn't be complete unless he was a duo, and managed to sing harmony to this fellow and did manage to play the guitar fairly well. So as of second year of college, went off to become a folk singer. No previous experience.
Now, there's a record that came out of this, and I was really surprised to see who the producer of the record was. It's Cree Taylor, who now has close to a whole jazz empire. And
yeah,
this was a little folk record.
Another fellow, a fellow named Phil Ramone was the engineer, who is also well known in rock circles these days. There's a lot of rock records. That was a long time ago. That was 1963 that we made the record. And we did reasonably well. We did hundreds of college concerts and played clubs here and there and had generally quite a good time at it.
Well, why don't we give a listen to a selection from this record from the group Brown and Dana. And the Brown is my guest, Garrett Brown, who is also the inventor of the Steadicam. But this is what they recorded back in 1963.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls and soft summer nights. We hid from the lights on the village green when I was 17. When I was 21, it was a very good year.
It was a very good year for city girls who lived up the stairs with perfumed hair that came undone when I was 21.
blooded girls of independent means. We rode in limousines, their chauffeurs would drive when I was 35. And now the days are short, I'm in the autumn of the year, and I think of my life as vintage wine from final case, from the brim to the dregs. It poured sweet and clear, it was a very good year. It
was a very good year, as recorded on an album by Brown and Dana, which was Garrett Brown, my guest, and Al Dana. Garrett Brown, if you're just joining us, is the inventor of the Steadicam, an invention which won him an Oscar earlier this year at the Academy Awards. That record was recorded in 1963. I just really had a, you know, chuckle as we were listening to it, because it's so world-weary when I was 21. I think of my life as vintage wine. Where were you at? 21.
I was doing a little visualizing about 35. Uh-huh. Who knew? I mean, at that age, who knows anything at that age? Maybe now, I don't know, but then certainly we knew nothing.
What do you think of the album now, when you look back?
I think it's a relic, you know. It is a relic of another age of recording, another kind of music. I mean, there are songs on there that were Negro spirituals and black sort of jazz pieces redone, and grotesque alterations of traditional tunes. Creed Taylor laid his strings and his percussion guys on there. I must say, I think we did have sort of bad luck in ending up on MGM's label when we didn't know what we wanted. You know, we played a relatively crisp little guitar number, and then on came the percussion guys and the studio sidemen, and it was sort of the Kingston Trio-ish sort of music, which is sort of mercifully faded away.
How did you go from there into your interest in film?
Well, I think my true abilities as a musician caught up with me eventually. I mean, I was sort of a partaking of this folk music phenomenon, and as that changed, as people started writing their own songs, I became a little more of a white elephant, and I gradually realized that that wasn't to be. My great career was not to be as a music guy, you know. And I started thinking, well, good Lord, there's nothing else I'm equipped to do. I sold Volkswagens for a while. And then I plunged gratefully into advertising, great sort of bolt hole for ne'er-do-wells. And advertising provided me with refuge when I needed it most. I was able to write things without being a great literary talent. I was able to learn how to shoot film without having to jump into the feature business right away. So it was good, very good for me. I managed to get a film company together and make my escape in good order, you know.
Let's continue with the This Is Your Life section of today's interview with Garrett Brown. we happen to have here a couple of recorded radio commercials that Garrett Brown wrote for advertising. I guess this was not in the early part, though, of your
Well, no, later. I mean, I did have
experience.
A lot of fun with advertising in certain times. We got a chance to do a number of ad lib radio commercials, more or less along the lines of Nichols and May sort of thing. And that was fun for me. I was a girl named Ann Wynn that did them with me, and you'll hear Ann and myself, I think, on the first one here.
Yeah.
And people would come to us when they hadn't a clue what to do to sell whatever it was, and we would go down in the studio with a sort of electronic editing setup that I came up with, and we were able to just almost spin this stuff off top of the head sort of dialogue. and then go back and do one again and insert one word or change a syllable. So it was very convenient electronically. And produce what was a little more fresh and unwritten sort of material.
Okay, well, let's listen to one of these commercials that Garrett Brown is describing. And this is one of the improvisational ones that he did.
Hi. Mind if I make camp here?
It's a beautiful spot.
Well, I really wanted to be alone, but it's okay, really.
No, you can something else. No, really.
Is that all your stuff?
Oh, yeah, this is my camping stuff.
A cooler?
Yeah, that's it.
That's all you brought?
It's full of Molson beer. Imported from Canada.
Hey, isn't that funny? I was just thinking how great it would be to have a beer.
Oh, it's a wonderful beer. A clean taste.
Hey, would you like a hamburger?
Bottles. John Molson said in 1786, it's an honest brew that just makes its own friends,
like
which is
hamburger.
True. I'd love a hamburger.
Okay. What are you going to do if it rains?
Oh, I don't know. I'll make out somehow.
Well, I have a drop cloth here. You can make a tent out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
That's all you brought is a case of Molson?
That's all I ever bring.
Enjoy a frosty bottle of Molson. It has a clean, fresh taste as big as Canada. Molson Beer and Ale, imported daily into the U.S. by Martlett Importing Company, Great Neck, New York.
Well, would you like a Molson?
Sure I would. I thought you'd never ask.
You have an opener, right?
Okay, we just heard an example of a radio commercial that was done by my guest, Garrett Brown, and we're hearing these because just as the folk singing record...
Why are we hearing these?
Just as the folk singing record is a surprising part of his career, I think these radio commercials are too. You have to... if you're just joining us, I should tell you that Garrett Brown has won an Oscar for his work as the inventor of the Steadicam, which is a camera that has done incredible things for the film industry. And he had said earlier to me today that he seems to shed careers like, what was the other half of that?
Duck sheds, I said feathers, I think, but that doesn't sound
shed
very good,
feathers,
does it?
No.
Water, all right, there it is, water.
We're losing it.
Fading.
But anyways, as you can tell, he's been through a number of different and very successful ventures. Let's go back.
It does meander a bit, doesn't it? I didn't realize it, but, you know, there's no logical thread there that one can pick up from singing to...
improvisational radio commercials.
Commercials to inventing.
Steadicams.
I don't know why that
Let's
is.
Let's see if we could find a hook maybe earlier in advertising, when you got into advertising and got your first camera and stuff.
I was strongly motivated to get into the film production end of it. I don't know where that came from, but having never picked up a camera until I was 26, I suddenly was obsessed with the idea of learning how to shoot and getting together the paraphernalia to make films. And in fact, I went to local film production companies in town and prostrated myself at the door and offered to do anything, you know, the classic sweep floors, whatever, and couldn't generate any interest in that department. I didn't look like good floor sweeping material, I don't think. And finally had no recourse but to go to the library and read a bunch of titles on film production and give myself a vocabulary, a filmy sort of vocabulary, so I could say, hey, D-lines, hey, you know, lavenders, whatever, and superficially make an impression on somebody just sufficient to let them have enough confidence to give me a chance.
Well, I'm told if you can't do that there's no way you're going to get in anywhere. You know, if you don't know, like, the right vocabulary to use, and if you don't know how to officially, like, say, line up a script on a page.
Yeah, it's what it amounted to. The business sort of conned itself, and I mean, it was only open to con men equally adept as the people that were in the business, I guess. I sort of became a con man to get myself into advertising to start with. And one fellow who was, you know, either astute or not, depending on the historical results, gave me a job finally writing commercials and copy and so on.
I understand that there was one shot you were trying to do for an ad that entailed hanging a camera from a helicopter.
Yeah, I've always had a sort of mechanical bent, and quickly, once we got in the production business, I found that one thing I could do as well as anybody that was currently active was rigging and crazy special effect shots. And so I sort of made a study of that end of the business. And if people had a shot that they couldn't get done anywhere else, we generally found a way to do it we hung a camera 30 feet below a helicopter in the instance you're talking about, and found out that it looks on screen like a ground-level camera. You could fly it along 4 or 5 feet above the ground, and it would give the impression that the camera was floating, a sort of animation of what came later with the invention. This one had the advantage that it could fly away, though, and do those spectacular flying away end shots that were so popular in the 60s in commercials.
Do you still use things like that?
Well, I haven't personally been the producer of commercials for a couple of years, but I still end up hanging around trying to figure out how to do shots that are difficult for one reason or another. I guess I sort of have a reputation now for being inclined that way, so people call up and say, how can we do this or how can we do that?
You were saying a while ago that sometimes it happens that two people arrive from either end of the globe or country or state to the patent office within a half hour of each other, not because they've stolen each other's ideas, but because they've just simultaneously arrived at the solution to the same problem.
Well, that's the nightmare, you know. When I began to think like an inventor along the way, because I had to go through all the inventor-type motions. In fact, so help me, I even went to Washington with the prototype, and I rode up the elevator of the patent office with this machine, and people were looking at it, you know, and smiling, because it's like a joke, a cartoon, you know. And I sat in the anteroom at the patent office, like all those cartoons you've seen, holding this bizarre contraption, sitting next to the guy with the glasses with a windshield wiper and the fellow holding a duck-shaped object and the guy with a death ray. I mean, we were all there looking at each other suspiciously, waiting for the examiner. In fact, we couldn't explain how this worked to the patent office without finally bringing it down there, which is very unusual these days.
What did you do before that point? You know, like while you were developing it, while you were developing the idea, what did you do to prevent anyone from finding out enough about what you were doing to steal the idea? Because sometimes even just finding out you're doing it is enough
to plant
something in someone's mind.
As I had more and more of my own money invested in it, you tend to get paranoid. We would hear that somebody in France made a shot that, you know, could only have been done this way, and so I'd worry for 6 months and ask people, did you hear anything about this? And they'd say no. We heard a shot, somebody described a shot that could only have been done this way, and I was in a panic, you know, and I finally it was such an uproar mentally that I finally made some inquiries and found out that they had managed to do this, create this effect by running the camera backwards and using a 30-foot crane arm, which is more of the elaborate machinery we were trying to replace. So there was great jubilation that night when we found out that it was not threatening, you know. And I'm very aware that ideas sort of have a time, and when an idea's time has come, who knows what it is, spores in the atmosphere or comic books or whatever, why then various people come up with it, you know. So I did go through all those sort of inventor paranoia things. Attempting to get a patent, one has to teach oneself an entirely new language. I mean, patenting is not the mail in your application, wait for the patent idea than I expected it to be. I now have 33 patent applications running in the world, and all of them involve just swarms of paperwork from the Japanese council and the German council and the French council. And
you've brought some fabulous little pieces of literature with you.
Well, I thought you might get a kick out of the language of a patent application. It came as a complete shock to me to realize that I had to be able to not only read this sort of stuff, but to generate words like this. I read a sample paragraph from the issued U.S. patent number 4,017,168. Similarly, a double bifurcated lower link pivotally interconnects between the medial block and the harness mounting block 64 below the upper link connections. An upper medial pivot in pin 72 and a lower medial pivot pin 70 respectively pivotally interconnect one end of the upper link 68 and one end of the lower link 66 with the medial block 60.
How do you read that? I mean, because do you have a lawyer who can go through all of that word by word? Is your lawyer mechanically inclined?
Yes, he's a patent attorney, a firm of patent attorneys. Unfortunately for me, they're extremely good. They walked me through this process in the beginning, and now we're sort of working together to keep it going. We just are now in the process of defending the patent worldwide, and we have successfully defended it once against, you know, people that we alleged copied the thing, and we went after them in court, and they've now settled and are paying a royalty. And now the Japanese, there's a so-called Japanese version of the thing, and the Japanese attorneys are sending polite notes to one another. And now I get in the mail translated Japanese expert opinions on whether or not the, you know, the double bifurcated lower link perfectly interconnects between the medial block. It's pretty incredible. I know, and that part of it has all been a complete surprise to me for some reason.
Is there any way of avoiding that if you invent something brilliantly in the near future?
Well, there is an alternative. I've been reading the literature of inventing. There was a wonderful fellow named Alberto Santos Dumont in the early part of this century. And he was a brilliant character. He invented things in aviation and lighter than air, heavier than air. He was definitely a pioneer aviator. And in fact, he made 20 or 30 small airships and used to fly them around Paris by himself, just 20 feet long, kind of put together out of strips of silk and glue, and he would get caught in the air shaft of the Trocadero Hotel, and the ladies would toast him, and the firemen would come out and extricate him. And his solution was to simply publish articles on everything he did, to never patent anything, and to simply just give it to the world. Now, the practical version of that is to simply give a manufacturer some lead time by saying, here, I'm not going to patent it. You do it. Give me a very small percentage. Let everybody else do it, and the only way you'll succeed is to be the best. The temptation otherwise is to rely on this little piece of paper, bifurcated, blah, 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 to be your protection, and it's very difficult these days. You're probably better off just spending your time on engineering. The courts aren't favorably dealing with patents nowadays anyway, generally.
Patents of individuals or of corporations?
Individuals or corporations. Yeah. I mean, Polaroid has now even got their troubles with Kodak, so the patent isn't necessarily the answer.
I imagine that you have been making a lot of money, both because of the camera and also because of the shooting that you've been asked to do.
Not really. I mean, a lot of people think that. I nothing extraordinary. It's a very small market, first of all, professional equipment. In the world, there are maybe 130 of these machines now.
So this hasn't, like, drastically altered your
lifestyle?
No,
I'm certainly not a millionaire or anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm comfortable from it. I probably could live on the royalties if I wanted to scale my activities down somewhat. But, it's not a gold mine.
I think a lot of people are surprised, that you're still living in Philly, which isn't to say anything about Philadelphia, but the film industry isn't located here. It's located in Los Angeles, and that's where...
Well, it's located in New York and London and elsewhere. Yeah. I found out finally that wherever I was the wrong place anyway. I needed to be somewhere else, so I like living here. It's an excellent town for me, for some reason. And I'm as far away as the airport from anything. I've been commuting to London alternate weeks on the Concorde lately, so...
For The Shining?
Yeah, so...
How do you like working with Stanley Kubrick?
Well, I like it. It's frustrating, maddening experience. He is a sort of guy that drives everyone crazy around him, but generally it's been a good experience for me, good learning experience.
Do you feel at all kind of sucked into the whole Hollywood or, film stardom mystique, because you've been spending time with, kind of heroes of of American pop culture and of American film culture.
Not really. I mean, everybody has feet of clay, and they're all human mortals, all struggling to deal with a whole set of conditions. I had a chance to watch Sylvester Stallone early in his career and recently, and I think he's fundamentally the same guy. He's now superficially, an egomaniac and so on. And my reading of that would be it's a response to the sort of monster he's created. He's being mobbed on the street, and people are tearing off the doors off trailers to get at him. And
were you shocked by that?
Maybe he went overboard on the cult hero routine. I have a feeling he'd like to be a little less known at this point. But fundamentally, he's the same guy.
You never know what's going to happen to a film when you're shooting it. I mean, you don't even know if it's going to, turn up when it's when it's developed, let alone become a smashing success. Were you absolutely shocked when you saw the effect that Rocky had on people?
Oh, we were astounded, yeah. I mean, we thought that it was a B picture. When you were working on it, it was impossible to know otherwise. We knew that Stallone's stuff was very appealing, but It's impossible, I think, to predict $148 million smashes. If it was possible, there'd be more films that made it.
Do you find yourself going to the movies more or less now that you're, you know, involved with the creation of them?
No more or no less than before. I find that if I worked on a film, I'm almost spoiled for seeing it like a normal person because I'm sitting there watching the frame line and is the picture steady and, you know, all this silly stuff, or waiting for shots that I did, or wondering why the editor could dare cut out 20 feet of some beautiful take in the sunset or something, you know. So I much prefer to see films that I didn't work on.
But you still see shots of yours, I guess, within the not of your cameras, that is, within some of those films.
That's fun. I mean, even watching television now, one sees the odd shot that the camera made, and you know right away it was no other way for something to be done.
Is that ever in the credits, you know, that a Steadicam was used?
Or a Steadicam operator, such and such. We know it's still a very small fraternity, so we still know most of the people in the world who are good at it. And in fact, I go to industrial shows, camera shows, every now and then. One in particular is Photokina in Germany, and it's a great experience because the leading Romanian operator will suddenly appear, guy that I never met before, you know, and he will put the camera on and then go, you know, demonstrating how it works, and, you know, you can be quite good with this thing, and you can just make it do magical tricks if you're good at it. And we'll suddenly look over, and there'll be a complete stranger who's a magician with the thing, you know. So it's gradually spreading all over the world, and that's terrific fun.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Garrett Brown, who's the inventor of the Steadicam, the camera that we're talking about. Have you known anyone who's used your camera, like, for, you know, experimental film, for non-narrative cinema? Of course, experimental filmmakers tend to gravitate to the cheapest equipment around.
That's us, folks. It isn't cheap to buy, but it's cheap to use.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, actually, another aspect of all this, which is delightful, is I now hear about some startling projects. A Frenchman visited me on the set of The Shining, named Jean-Paul Jeune, who was an operator of the camera. And they contemplated a one-hour shot, uninterrupted one-hour shot on videotape. It wasn't Les Miserables, it was a French television production. And I hear that he survived making a one-hour shot. I mean, the camera weighs a fair amount, and I thought at the time I wouldn't want to be asked to shoot an hour take without making a mistake. And I said, well, what happens if you make one mistake in framing or something? He says, we start over, which is great. And evidently, in one take, they got an hour shot.
And then
they also did another film.
It?
No, I haven't seen it. They're sending me a cassette, so I'll get a look at it. They did a film entirely subjective, much like some of the early experiments that Hitchcock made. But here now, the camera can now move like a person without the elaborate dollies and wheels and so on. So, entirely subjective, the camera saw life as a participant in this film for an hour and a half. And I think it was a film on the torture of political prisoners, so it was fairly rough, dramatic stuff, where one might have, in fact, been tempted to do it handheld in the traditional way, and they wanted to, you know, make it a little easier to watch and a little more realistic, so they went with our thing.
Who are some of your favorite cinematographers and directors?
Well, directors is difficult because my view of a director is it's sort of tunnel vision. I mean, I have a particular relationship with them, attempting to get a particular action sequence, and it's very hard to... My favorite directors have nothing much to do with shooting. Woody Allen is one of my favorite directors, to my knowledge, well, I've never shot for him. I don't know if he's used the camera or not. I like directors for a different reason than cameramen. Now, cameramen, my favorite, I guess, would be Haskell Wexler. I like Conrad Hall a great deal. I like other people's work that I haven't had a chance to work with. Owen Roisman, for one. It's a part of the business that is of great interest to me. I mean, I've been asked now to be director of photography on various things, and I have to make a decision. Do I want to be a cameraman? It would almost mean giving up operating and using the machine. And on the one hand, I don't want to go on 20 years being a strong back, weak mind, sort of lug the camera around guy, but it's quite a commitment to become a cameraman. I almost hate to have that label put on me. You know?
Well, why do you say that? Why the weak mind half of that strong back?
No, I mean if you're just carrying it around, if you're operating it.